Some of the views expressed on the Mormon Channel are solely for the education and inspiration of our audience and may not represent the official position of the church.
I'm Nathan Wright, and you're listening to the Mormon Channel of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The year 1890 brought an official end to the practice of polygamy within the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. 3 years later, members of the church were eager to share who they were at the Chicago World's Fair, or as it was called, the Columbian Exposition. Here to discuss the efforts of the church and of the Utah Territory at that exposition is writer and historian Reed L. Nielsen. Reed is currently managing director of the Church History Department and has recently published through Oxford University Press, Exhibiting Mormonism, the Latter-day Saints, and the 1893 Chicago World's Fair. Reed, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Nathan. It's great to be here with you.
Please take a few moments, and if you would tell us about yourself and how you acquired such an obvious love of church history.
Well, I do love church history, and it's been something that's been both a vocation and avocation for much of my life. For the past few years, I have been the managing director of the Church History Department, which has enabled me to see the incredible depth and breadth of church history work going on around the world. We collect, we preserve, and we share the church's history thanks to the generosity and kindness of so many Latter-day Saints scattered around the globe. Previous to coming up here to work at the church, I worked down at Brigham Young University in Provo as a professor of church history and doctrine, where I was able to teach classes on the International Church, the Doctrine of Covenants, and general church history. I had a marvelous experience there and here. Prior to that, I did my PhD at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, where I was able to do my dissertation on Latter-day Saints missionary work in Asia and the Pacific. And it was actually during that time, during my graduate school years, that I took a class on transnational Buddhism. It was a class at both Duke and Chapel Hill that talked about how Buddhism was introduced to America. And so every week we'd go back and forth on a bus between the two campuses and talk about how Buddhism went from Asia to America and then America to Asia and what happened through these contacts and exchanges. And we learned about how Buddhism both was similar in Asia, but also was transformed in America just by American culture and society and ideas, and how people were fascinated by Asian religions, particularly at the end of the 19th century when Asian religions came into vogue, particularly among intellectuals on the Eastern Seaboard. It was during this class that we did a unit on the Chicago World's Fair, the subject of this book that you're referencing. And I learned all about the Buddhists and the Hindus and the Sikhs and Muslims who came to Chicago in the summer of 1893 to represent their own religions. And as we got into the course, I was very curious about the Mormons. Were they there? You know, did our church have representation? Did we have a voice at the Parliament of Religions, which was part of the Chicago World's Fair? And lo and behold, I came across some references to B.H. Roberts, who was then in the presidency of the 70, who had gone back at the request and direction of the first presidency to try and get representation there in Chicago. And what unfolded was an absolutely fascinating story surrounding Mormon identity, surrounding how people viewed the Latter-day Saints. Again, as you mentioned in the introduction, this was only 3 years since President Wilford Woodruff had issued the manifesto, which effectively was the beginning of the end of plural marriage. And it was a unique window into religion in America. It was a window into Mormon studies. It was a window into Asian religions because that was part of the larger story. But as I began to investigate further and further, I came to appreciate that it was a window into all sorts of other things that were interesting to me.
Thank you. Prior to this 1893 exhibition, there must have been some efforts by the church somewhere, somehow, to exhibit itself. Is that true or not?
That's a great question. And in fact, there were. And it's kind of a play on words, exhibiting Mormonism. There's a famous book called Exhibiting Religion that talks about how world's fairs were utilized by different faiths to share their own message. And so I want to do something similar. It's a play on that particular title. Of course, in the 19th century, from the time of the first vision, when Joseph Smith started talking about the roots of the Restoration, we focused on missionary work. We really focused on telling people or in scriptural parlance, about warning your neighbor. Once you've been warned, what are we to do? Warn our neighbor. Just about everything we did was missionary-minded. We evangelized. We proselyted. We wanted to help other people be prepared for the Lord's second coming, which in the 19th century, saints felt was very close at hand. And so you had missionaries going out doing spectacular things like leaving families without purse or script and traveling to the Pacific or traveling to Asia or Europe and relying on the generosity of locals and church members to fulfill the biblical commission to take the gospel to all the world, as described in the book of Matthew. But we weren't particularly good or concerned with public relations efforts. And one of the things I try and explain or differentiate in the book is the separation between missionary work and public relations work. Although today sometimes those two things get blurred and blended in appropriate ways, in the 19th century there were two very different things. In fact, it wasn't until about the end of the 19th century that you even had the concept of public relations or public affairs anywhere in the world, not just in the church, but anywhere in the world. Companies didn't have public affairs departments. They didn't have public relations firms. This was a much more recent vintage of experience and skill set that have been employed largely by businesses. And now, of course, it's religious organizations, political organizations, etc. And so in the 19th century, really what you had was people simply trying to tell their story, exhibiting their own message, whatever it might be. And so up until this time, Latter-day Saints largely taught people the gospel. And it was something you're either with us or you're not. You either join the kingdom or you don't. And it was only about this time, with all the fervor and as the church faced financial and almost social annihilation leading up to the manifesto in 1890, that the brethren started to say, hey, we've done a phenomenal job with missionary work. We've gotten our message out. We've been able to tell people what we're about. But at the same time, we haven't been really as effective in making friends. We need to do both. We need to both warn people but also befriend people, even those that aren't interested in our message. We need to be friends and we need to have good relationships if we're in fact going to succeed in the modern world. That was a real sort of coming of age or realization moment, I think, for leaders of the church. And it was showcased most spectacularly and for really the first time at the Chicago World's Fair. Here's the moment in 1893 when the entire world has its eyes on America and Chicago, and the Latter-day Saints were able to dance on that stage in a real special and notable way.
So when I think of a fair, I think of in terms like a state fair. Mm-hmm. I've never been to a World's Fair.
Well, this was a world exposition. Or the World's Fair, there's many different words that they used to describe it. They really started, the first big one that captured people's attention was in 1851, the Great Exhibition in Great Britain. This is where the British demonstrated and showed to the world their technology and their superiority in so many different ways. And it caught fire. Pretty soon you have other nations saying, we want to do the same thing. The idea just it took people's imagination. And so you have a series of World's Fair all through the 19th century. And people wanted to do things that would just show off how superior they were to other nations. And they'd often build something to say, look what we can do. So you have the Great Exposition of 1851 in Britain. In the later 19th century, you have the Great Paris Exposition. They created the Eiffel Tower just to show people the engineering marvels of the French. That was all for the fair. And people liked it so much, they decided not to take it down after. That's why they have the Eiffel Tower today. And so this was something that happened all over the world. Philadelphia in 1876 had one of these expositions. And again, it just showcased what America was doing. Well, finally, in the years leading up to 1892, which would be the 400th anniversary of Christopher Columbus arriving in the New World, Americans once again said, hey, we're coming of age. We want to be major players on the world stage. We want to show what we're doing. And so they determined to host a World's Fair. And again, like you say, this is not your garden variety of local county fair down at the fairgrounds. This was a spectacular undertaking, which was underwritten in part by municipalities and by national governments. This was a chance to showcase or exhibit to the world what you had to offer. And so it was unprecedented in the history of America. And what I love is what the Americans produced. You know, the French, they do the Eiffel Tower, it's spectacular. Well, the Americans are thinking, what can we do to show up the French? They come up with the idea of a Ferris wheel. First Ferris wheel was invented and produced and enjoyed by fairgoers in Chicago in 1893. And so in my office, I have a little model Ferris wheel to remind me what the Americans were trying to showcase their ingenuity. And this was not just a small Ferris wheel. This Ferris wheel was hundreds of feet in diameter. It was a marvel. The world had never seen anything like it. And it became the symbol of the progress of America.
So something this vast and big and worldwide would have taken some real commitment on anybody who wanted to be part of it. And so the Utah Territory Commission comes up with a commission to be part of the World's Fair.
Well, as part of this national or international exposition, of course, the federal government was involved in the selection process and in some fundraising for it. They determined that they wanted to showcase the contributions of Americans all across the country. And so they invited proposals from each of the states or territories to come and to get lots to build a building or to showcase their contributions to America and to the larger world. And so Utah at the time was still a territory. It would not become a state until 1896, 3 years later. And many of both the Latter-day Saints and other members of faiths in Utah determined to get together, and they said, this is a chance where we can show both the rest of the nation and the world what we've accomplished and why we should gain statehood. It was a real political move as much as anything else. They wanted statehood. They thought, what better place to highlight our progress and contributions than in Chicago? And so there's some great stories surrounding the Utah Territorial Commission. Some people were quite excited about it. Others really struggled with it. Again, at this time, the United States was in a recession. There was a horrible recession in 1892, and so funds that people expected to be used for this event were suddenly gone. And so they had to reach out. The chambers of commerce, the local municipalities, all had to pool their resources to get together. And in a very real sense, it was a marvelous opportunity or chance for the Latter-day Saints to work with members of other faiths in Utah with a shared purpose. They wanted to put Utah's best foot forward. They weren't as concerned whether it was a Mormon foot or a non-Mormon foot. They simply wanted to promote Utah. And one great story that I love was one of the main promoters there was not a Latter-day Saint and was famous for smoking cigars. And when they were trying to figure out what the best lot or land would be for the Utah building, they sent him back. He was an old miner and engineer, a very determined, dogged soul. And he went back there, and it was raining that day. It was raining so hard. And a lot of the people from the other states decided that they'd stay indoors and just wait until the committee went out that day. Well, he had the idea that as a miner, possessions was key. You know, if you possessed the land or something else, well, it would take a lot to get you off it. So he got his cigars and got an umbrella and had an overcoat and went and squatted that morning early on the piece of land, the best piece of land at the Chicago Fairgrounds. And then when the other people came out with their umbrellas, he was simply sitting there smoking a cigar. And we have great accounts of him sitting there with the smoke swirling up the umbrella. And darn it, he got the piece of land that he wanted. And everyone patted him on the back, and I think many of his more sophisticated Easterners were most impressed that something could come from what they considered to be a very backwater territory like Utah, that Utah had won the prize and got the best piece of land. So there's some fun stories of how they made this thing actually happen.
The book is called Exhibiting Mormonism, The Latter-day Saints in the 1893 Chicago World's Fair. We're visiting with author Reed Nielsen today on Legacy. So you just described the fairgrounds. On the cover of the book, I see a building, which must be the Utah building with a nice statue of Brigham Young here. Did they build this building for the World's Fair? Was it existing? How'd that work?
they did build it. As I mentioned earlier, there was fairgrounds that had a number of lots that were going to be divided up among the states and territories of the American Republic. And so once they got the land, they had to decide, what are we going to build? And they did a competition, which was quite common in those days. They had a number of local architectural firms come in and say, what would you come up with if you wanted to showcase the best Utah has to offer? What would you design? And so a local Salt Lake firm won the commission and then partnered with some folks, a building company back in Chicago, to actually erect the building. Now, something that was interesting about these particular buildings was the fact that they were to be temporary buildings. They needed to look spectacular, but they also knew that after being up for about 6 or 8 months, they were going to be torn down. And so what they wanted to do was have a very pretty exterior. They wanted to have a very beautiful interior, but the longevity of the building was never in question. They knew it would be gone. And so the exterior, again, is beautiful. It was not costly, but very beautiful, very temporary. And the interior was something that they assembled, they enjoyed for about 6 months, and then they disassembled and were able to sell off the materials from inside the building. And the Utah building does not exist today. As recently as earlier this year in January, I was in Chicago at a conference and actually went out to the fairgrounds and saw where the Utah building was and stood on that spot and tried to imagine, based on photographs and maps that I've had in my possession, what it was like to be there with the Utah building surrounded by all of these other state and territorial buildings and exhibits.
You mentioned that the church was working with other religions just to get back there, have a nice thing for all the religions, putting Utah's best foot forward. Was the church working with the Utah World's Fair Commission as well? Was it church and state or separated, or how'd that work?
Well, the church itself had a couple different approaches to being involved. Number one, since the majority of the members of the state were Latter-day Saints, by virtue of everything they did, you had a Mormon presence and operations. For instance, many of the people that were involved in the territories exhibition were Latter-day Saints acting under no official church capacity, but they were Latter-day Saints wanting to put the church's best foot forward. And so they showcased and highlighted the Mormon pioneers coming in and settling the Utah territory. They talked about Brigham Young quite a bit. Of course, he was the most famous Latter-day Saint at that time. People still knew about him, the American Moses. They wanted to know what he did with irrigation and settlement and everything else. They also showcased many of the Mormon buildings that were part of the Utah territorial fabric of society, the Tabernacle, the Salt Lake Temple. They had little mock-ups of each of those buildings. Then you had women from the Relief Society that were very involved in partnering with their non-Mormon sisters in a women's delegation. Again, were they trying to advance the Latter-day Saint agenda? Of course. At the same time, they were trying to advance the role of women in Utah, whether they be Latter-day Saint or someone of another faith. Then you have the church itself, who basically was represented by B.H. Roberts, a member of the Presidency of the 70. He was the real official church spokesman there, and of course he had his own challenges when he was in Chicago, as many of the Protestant organizers tried to thwart his participation. And so you had official church participation, quasi-church participation, and then you had simply territorial participation. But Latter-day Saints ran throughout all three operations.
If I remember correctly, most religions of the world received an invitation, but the Latter-day Saints didn't.
That's right. In fact, the Latter-day Saints, as I point out in the book, they were the one group in certainly North America and the one group that of the known religions of the world that was not formally invited. The Protestant committee that put this together was trying to showcase Protestant superiority. They wanted the nations of the world to come and say, wow, look what you Protestants have done. Wow, you have progressed so much. Wow, you have so much to offer. Why don't you come and send missionaries to India or Africa or wherever you might be? Convert us, we'll become more like you. This was a very ethnocentric, a very widely spread idea in the 19th century. They talked about it as the white man's burden or the Christian burden. It was going to be the white Christians from North America that were going to redeem the world. They were going to save everybody else. Well, something happened on the way to the Chicago World's Fair. Most other religions determined that they wanted to come, but when they arrived, they turned the tables on their Protestant organizers. And that's a whole other story. But what I find fascinating about the LDS participation or desired participation was that although they were known as a very important American religious group, while they had just renounced the practice of plural marriage, while they were trying to become more and more mainstream America and gain statehood for Utah, the Protestants said, there's no way you're going to be part of what we're doing. We do not even want you here. We don't want people to see this American religion that we see is so backward because of the practice of plural marriage. We think that you're heretical. We think that you're apostate. No, we want nothing to do with you. And so it took the determination and kind of the street smarts of B.H. Roberts to actually get us at least informal representation there in the Parliament of Religions, a fascinating story in and of itself.
I really enjoyed that part. So as you mentioned, there was a Congress of Representative Women going on, the Parliaments of Religions going on, as well as something that our listeners may be a little more familiar with, the Welsh Eisteddfod Music Competition.
Right.
Tell us a little bit more about what happened.
Well, at these world fairs, they tried to think of all the different ways that they could, again, showcase the best locals had to offer. And so they were there in Chicago, and they reached out to all sorts of different groups in America. And in the past, at some of these international gatherings, the Welsh, who were world-renowned for their singing abilities and their choral groups, said, you know, wouldn't it be great if we actually had one of these choral competitions where on the international stage, when everyone's looking at America, the Welsh from America really showed their dominance and showed how powerful they were as singers. And so the Welsh, largely from Pennsylvania, where they had a major immigrant population, reached out to their Welsh brother and sisters back in Wales. And they said, in conjunction with the World's Fair, how would you feel if we did this year's choral competition in Chicago at the World's Fair? And they said, great, this would be a great opportunity for us to draw attention to the superior of the Welsh as singers, whether they be American immigrant Welsh or whether they be native Welsh in Wales. Well, to make a long story short, a number of Welsh groups in America, as long as other choirs, determined to participate. They wanted to come and be there to compete for large purses of money. The prize money was pretty good, several hundred dollars, and you got medals and incredible publicity. So the Welsh were very excited about this. This was going to be their contribution to the fair. And you have to think, at the time, Welsh Americans were not treated particularly well. Just like many other European immigrants, they were seen as not quite up to snuff. They were not seen as good as perhaps their English co-colonists in America. And they wanted to remedy this. This was their moment, their stage. Well, one of the editors of a well-known Welsh newspaper from Pennsylvania came out west on a tour. He wanted to visit the heartland of America, the Rockies, and some of the western environs. And he passed through Utah because he had some ties to Utah because of some of his fellow Welshmen who back in Wales had converted to the gospel of Jesus Christ and moved to Utah. So he wanted to see what these Welshmen were doing out in Utah. He came to visit Salt Lake and Provo and some other parts of Utah and heard for the first time the Salt Lake Tabernacle Choir. Now, we think of it as the Mormon Tabernacle Choir today, but back in the early 1890s, there was the Salt Lake Tabernacle Choir. There was an Ogden Tabernacle Choir, which they competed against each other, and by no means was it settled which was the best choir at the time. In fact, at a subsequent World's Fair, the church sent the Ogden, not the Salt Lake Tabernacle Choir, because at that point, that choir was viewed as the most superior a decade later, which is an interesting side story. But at the time, he came to the tabernacle, and he heard the choir, and was absolutely stunned and was convinced and shared with his writers back in Pennsylvania and Wales that perhaps the best choir in the world was not in Pennsylvania or Wales. It was in Salt Lake City, Pioneer, Utah. And his readers were stunned. And in his writings, he said, yeah, you might think I'm crazy, but really, you need to come here. You need to experience what it's like to be surrounded by hundreds of voices in the tabernacle and hear them sing sacred music. And he was also impressed that Evan Stevens was a Welshman. He had joined the church with his family as a young boy and had walked across the plains. And so here you have a Welshman who was leading this choir made up of a large percentage of Welsh. It was a Welsh choir. In fact, it started as a Welsh choir organized by Brigham Young because the Welsh had the singing ability. And he said, Brother Stevens, in effect, your choir's spectacular. I think you could compete. And told them all about this. And he said, will you come back to Chicago? And he said, well, this might be a neat opportunity. Again, the church didn't think of public relations then as they do today. Today, the Mormon Tabernacle Choir has really become one of the right arms of the entire public relations effort of the church. The choir can go and touch hearts and meet people that the institutional church cannot. It can open doors for the brethren and the missionaries in remarkable ways. Well, there was a lot of negotiation back and forth. There was the recession of 1892 that I had mentioned, and for a time it seemed that the Mormons would not be able to go back to Chicago and sing as the Tabernacle Choir. Finally, it was actually George Buchanan, a member of the First Presidency, who said, I feel impressed that they need to go, that this will be a wonderful opportunity for them. And so, for the first time, they left the territory of Utah. They had never left Utah prior to 1893. They go back to Chicago en masse. They take Pullman cars where they have huge banners saying Mormon Tabernacle Choir or the Mormons. And the entire First Presidency goes back and they compete in this Welsh choral competition. And while they do so well, they miss the gold medal. They get the silver medal. But it's the first time they've been out of the territory of Utah and people are blown away by what the Mormons can do. And the Welsh were just absolutely enthused that the Mormons were there, but felt very threatened because this was their moment to shine. And so you have this wonderful interplay between the Welsh and the Mormon Welsh trying to show who's more dominant in this field. But it really was the coming out party for the Tabernacle Choir. It was their entrance to the stage of choral performance beyond Utah. And they were feted and beloved and celebrated at every turn.
It's a great story. It seems in the past couple decades, with the worldwide information explosion facilitated mostly by the internet, that we have arrived again at a place where the church leaders desire to exhibit their faith rather than allow others to exhibit it. And I recall an Elder Ballard conference talk about that very thing.
I appreciate the words of Elder Ballard. I think he was prophetic in what he was saying in a variety of different settings where he's encouraged members of the church to tell their own story rather than having that story told by others. And again, as you point out, I think this really goes back to the tenor of the times in 1893 where they came to appreciate really for the first time the utility of saying, we're not just telling a missionary story, but we're going to tell a story that can be appreciated by lots of different people. You don't have to believe what we're telling you. You don't have to convert to the church. But please understand our message. Please show us respect and please know that we want to be good neighbors and partners with you. And I think that's really the tenor, if I understand it, of Elder Ballard and the good work that he's suggesting that members of the church do through blogs, through emails, through their own type of webcasts and other forms of electronic media, YouTube videos, etc. I think that President George Buchanan and Evan Stevens and B.H. Roberts would just say amen to everything. They would embrace and celebrate and appreciate all that he's suggesting that lay members of the church do today, that we exhibit ourselves rather than always being exhibited by others. And as we found in the church history department, along with other departments of the church, there's real power in shaping the conversation. You can help the conversation go in productive, constructive ways that if you just sit back passively and wait for others to determine the conversation, you can have an incredibly positive benefit and bless the lives of church members and others who simply want to learn about us. They may not want to convert, but they want to know about us. They want to be our friend. I just applaud the direction that we're going today.
Thank you. We've been visiting with historian Reed Nielsen, author of the new Oxford publication, Exhibiting Mormonism, the Latter-day Saints, and the 1893 Chicago World's Fair. Thank you, Reed, for being with us today.
Thank you for letting me join you.
This is Legacy on the Mormon Channel, a media outlet, The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.